The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. And the story today is The Divide by Lindsay Stern, a world-famous bonobo and the celebrated psychologist who raised him are no longer allowed to see each other, a story about the mysterious boundary between humans and apes. One spring day in 2005, a yellow school bus carrying six passengers turned onto a freshly paved driveway 7 miles southeast of downtown Des Moines, Iowa. Passing beneath a tunnel of cottonwood trees listing in the wind, it rumbled past a life-size sculpture of an elephant before pulling up beside a new building. Two glass towers loomed over the 13,000-square-foot laboratory, framed on three sides by a glittering blue lake. Sunlight glanced off the western tower, scrunching the faces pressed to the windows of the bus. Only three of them were human. When the back door swung open, out climbed Sue Savage Rumbaugh, her sister and collaborator Liz Pugh, a man named William Fields, and three bonobo apes, who were joining a group of five bonobos who had recently arrived at the facility. The $10 million 18-room compound, known then as the Great Ape Trust, bore little resemblance to a traditional research center. Instead of in conventional cages, the apes, who ranged in age from 4 to 35, lived in rooms linked by elevated walkways and hydraulic doors they could open themselves. There was a music room with drums and a keyboard, chalk for drawing, an indoor waterfall, and a sun-washed greenhouse stocked with bananas and sugarcane. Every feature of the facility was designed to encourage the apes' agency. They could help prepare food in a specialized kitchen, press the buttons of a vending machine for snacks, and select DVDs to watch on a television. A monitor connected to a camera outside allowed the bonobos to screen human visitors who rang the doorbell. Pressing a button, they granted or denied visitors access to a viewing area secured by laminated glass. But the center's signature feature was the keyboard of pictorial symbols, accessible on computerized touchscreens and packets placed in every room, and even printed on researchers' T-shirts. It consisted of more than 300 lexigrams corresponding to English words, a lingua franca that Savage Rumbaugh had worked and developed over many years to enable the bonobos to communicate with human beings. A lot of scientists don't want that kind of study done, because if the answer were yes, her eyes sparkled. Then, oh my God, who are we? And that was a little addition under her picture I was reading. Now back to the story. Before Savage Rumbaugh began her research, the bonobo, an endangered cousin of the chimpanzee, was little known outside the Congo River Basin. Savage Rumbaugh's 7 books and close to 170 articles about their cognitive abilities played a significant role in introducing them to the wider world. Her relationship with a bonobo named Kanzi, in particular, had made the pair something of a legend. Kanzi's aptitude for understanding spoken English and for communicating with humans using the lexigrams had shown that our hominid kin were far more sophisticated than most people had dared to imagine. By the time Kanzi arrived at the Great Ape Trust that day in 2005, his name had appeared in the Encyclopedia Britannica. In 2011, Time magazine named Savage Rumbaugh one of the world's 100 most influential people on the basis of her work with Kanzi and his family. None other than Franz de Waal, the world's preeminent primatologist, lauded her unique experiment. Her research had punched holes in the wall separating humans from apes, he wrote, a wall built upon the long-standing scientific consensus that language was humanity's unique and distinguishing gift. In November 2013, 8 years after she opened the trust and having made plans for a phased retirement, Savage Rumbaugh returned to Des Moines from a medical absence to care for Tico, Kanzi's 3-year-old nephew, who had injured his leg. The atmosphere was unusually tense. After a strained email exchange that continued for several days, the chair of the facility's board finally told her that she could no longer stay at the trust. Still concerned about Tico, Savage Rumbaugh refused to leave. But the next day, she complied, once the young bonobo was in the hands of another caretaker. When you depart, please leave your access card and any keys with whomever is on duty right now, the chairman wrote to her. Bewildered, Savage Rumbaugh retreated to the cottage she rented next door. Then she contacted a lawyer. What followed was a prolonged and ongoing custody battle unique in the history of animal research and in the movement for animal rights. At its heart is a question that continues to divide primatologists. What constitutes legitimate research into the inner lives of apes? I learned about the bonobos by accident. I was an MFA student at the Iowa Writers' Workshop in Iowa City, writing a novel that featured a scientist who studied birdsong. One afternoon, my teacher, the novelist Benjamin Hale, called me into his office. If I was interested in language and animals, he said, there was a place in nearby Des Moines that I needed to see. He had visited several years earlier while researching his novel, The Evolution of Bruno Littlemore, about a chimpanzee who learns to speak. He told me that the place was run by a brilliant but polarizing psychologist named Sue Savage Rumbaugh, and he gave me her contact information. I emailed Savage Rumbaugh. By then, I'd read about the numerous awards she had received and about the fiery debates her research had sparked in fields as far-flung as linguistics and philosophy. So I was surprised when she replied to say that her 30-year experiment had ended. Kanzi and his relatives were still living at the center, she told me. She could hear them from her cottage next door. We arranged to meet for lunch. Because I didn't have a car, we settled on a diner in Iowa City, 2 hours from Savage Rumbaugh's home in Des Moines. When I arrived, Savage Rumbaugh was already seated at a booth in the back corner, wearing a stained button-down shirt, purple pants, and a safari hat. Half of her right finger was missing, bitten off, she later said, by a frightened chimp she'd met in graduate school. I hope you don't mind, she said in a silvery voice, indicating her Caesar salad. She was 69, but looked younger, her warm green eyes peering out cautiously from underneath a mop of straight white hair. I asked Savage Rumbaugh what made her experiment different from other studies of ape intelligence. Experimental psychologists typically assume that there is a major difference between ourselves and apes that is not attributable to environmental factors, she said. The difference in my work is that I never made that assumption. Like renowned field primatologists Diane Fossey and Jane Goodall, Savage Rumbaugh interacted with the apes that she studied, but she'd done so in the confines of a lab, where scientists typically maintain an emotional distance from their animal subjects. And unlike Fosse and Goodall, Savage Rumbaugh had gone so far as to integrate into the group, co-rearing a family of bonobos over the course of several decades and engaging them in human ways. In 2015, her findings that the apes in her care could recognize their own shadows, learn to enter into contractual agreements, signal intent, assume duties and responsibilities, distinguish between the concepts of good and bad, and deceive, were used in a historic lawsuit that helped curtail biomedical testing on great apes in the United States. The findings also raised a fascinating, provocative, and deeply troubling question. Can an animal develop a human mind? It's a question you don't ask, Savage Rumbaugh said. A lot of people, a lot of scientists, don't want that kind of study done. Because if the answer were yes, her eyes sparkled, then, oh my God, who are we? She never planned to study bonobos. The oldest of seven children, born to a homemaker and a real estate developer in Springfield, Missouri, Sue Savage became fascinated. Excuse me while I turn the sheet of several pages. Fascinated how children acquire language while she was teaching her siblings to read. At Southwest Missouri University, she studied Freudian psychology and its counterpoint, behaviorism, B.F. Skinner's theory that behavior is determined by one's environment rather than by internal states such as thinking and feeling. She won a fellowship to study toward a doctorate at Harvard with Skinner himself, but turned it down to work with apes at the University of Oklahoma's Institute for Primate Studies, where the field of ape language was enjoying its heyday. She wrote her doctoral dissertation on nonverbal communication between mother and infant chimpanzees. At a symposium in 1974, she delivered a paper critiquing colleagues' attempts to teach American Sign Language to chimps. By focusing on what the apes signed, she argued, researchers were neglecting what they were already saying through their gestures and vocalizations, a view that earned her the nickname the Unbeliever. 6 months later, her phone rang. It was Duane Rumbaugh, the psychologist who had invited her to speak at the symposium. A position had opened up at Georgia State University, he said, with connections to the Yerkes Primate Research Center in Atlanta, the oldest institute in the United States for the study of non-human primates. The center was acquiring several chimp-like hominids, called bonobos, from the forests of the Congo River Basin in what was then Zaire. Was Savage Rumbaugh interested? She didn't have to think twice. Very little had appeared about bonobos in the scientific literature, but some researchers regarded them as a close living model of early humans. In their gait and facial structure, they resembled Australopithecus, a group of apes that went extinct about 2 million years ago and are believed to be among the ancestors of humankind. In time, research on free-living bonobos would reveal that they have a matriarchal social structure, and that, unlike chimps and humans, they almost never kill one another. Savage Rumbaugh accepted the position and packed her bags for Atlanta. Sure enough, the bonobos were eerily human-like. They often rose up to walk on two legs and responded to subtle changes in human caretakers' facial expressions. While the chimpanzees used their feeding pails as props in aggressive displays, the bonobos found a variety of nonviolent uses for them. A toilet, a container for drinking water, a hat. On one occasion, Savage Rumbaugh observed Kanzai's father carry his pail to the corner of his cage, from which he could see the shrieking chimps. He turned it over and sat there with his elbows on his knees watching them. In the spring of 1981, Rumbaugh's now married negotiated the transfer of six-month-old Kanzai and his adoptive mother, Matata, away from planned biomedical studies at Yerkes to live at the nearby Language Research Center, a facility they had established in collaboration with Georgia State University to explore the ape's cognitive abilities. There, Savage Rumbaugh introduced Matata to an early version of the Lexigram keyboard, which had helped enable some developmentally challenged children to communicate. While Kanzai frolicked around the lab, Savage Rumbaugh would sit beside his mother, hold up an object such as a sweet potato or a banana, and touch the corresponding symbol on a keyboard, indicating that Matata should press it herself. The training went nowhere. After 2 years, researchers temporarily called Matata back to Yerkes for breeding. By then, Savage Rumbaugh had despaired of collecting any publishable data on Matata, but she suspected she'd have more luck with the infant. Matata's absence consumed Kanzai. For 3 days, the only thing he wanted to do was look for Matata, Savage Rumbaugh recalled. We looked. She was under this bush. She was under there. After looking in the forest, he looked at every place in the lab that she could possibly hide. Exhausted, little Kanzai wandered over to a keyboard. Extending a finger, he pressed the key for Apple, and then the key for Chase. Then he looked at Savage Rumbaugh, picked up an apple lying on the floor, and ran away from her with a grin on his face. I was hesitant to believe what I was seeing, Savage Rumbaugh told me. Kanzi had evidently absorbed what his mother had not. He used the keyboard to communicate with researchers on more than 120 occasions that first day. Savage Rumbaugh rapidly adjusted her framework to encourage this capacity in Kanzi. She expanded the Lexigram keyboard to 256 symbols, adding novel words for places, things, and activities that seemed to interest him, such as lookout point, hide, and surprise. Rather than engage him in structured training sessions, she began using the Lexigrams with him continually throughout the day, labeling objects and placing all over the 55-acre property and recording what he said while out exploring. 17 months later, the young bonobo had acquired a vocabulary of 50 words. One study in 1986 showed that more than 80% of his multi-word statements were spontaneous, suggesting that he was not aping the gestures of humans, but was using symbols to express internal states of mind. But Kanzai's fifth birthday, or by Kanzai's fifth birthday, he had made the front page of the New York Times, most startling to the parade of scientists who came to Georgia to evaluate him, was his comprehension of some spoken English. Kanzai not only correctly matched spoken English words to their corresponding lexigrams, even while placed in a separate room from the person speaking, hearing the words through headphones, but he also appeared to grasp some basic grammar, pointing to chase, then hide, and then to the name of a human being or bonobo. He would initiate those activities with his interlocutor in that order. In a landmark study in the mid-1990s, Savage Rumbaugh exposed Kanzai to 660 novel English sentences, including, "Put on the monster mask and scare Linda," and, "Go get the balls Go get the ball that's outside, as opposed to a ball sitting beside you. In 72% of the trials, Kanzai completed the request, outcompeting a 2.5-year-old child. Yet his most memorable behavior emerged outside the context of replicable trials. Sampling kale for the first time, he called it slow lettuce. When his mother once hit him in frustration, he looked mournfully at Savage Rumbaugh and pressed Matata bite. When Savage Rumbaugh added symbols for the words good and bad to the keyboard, he seized on these abstract concepts, often pointing to bad before grabbing something from a caregiver, a kind of prank. Once, when Savage Rumbaugh's sister, Liz Pugh, who worked at the Language Research Center as a caregiver, was napping, Kanzai snatched the balled-up blanket she'd been using as a pillow. When Pugh jolted awake, Kanzai pressed the symbol for bad surprise. To some scientists, Kanzai's intellectual feats demonstrated clearly that language was not unique to human beings, but others were unimpressed. In my mind, this kind of research is more analogous to the bears in the Moscow circus who are trained to ride unicycles, said the Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker. To him, the fact that Kanzai had learned to produce elements of human communication didn't imply that he had the capacity for language. Thomas C. B. Oak, a prominent linguist who organized a conference in 1980 that helped squelch public funding for animal research, for animal language research, had a similar take. It has nothing to do with language, nothing to do with words, he said, when asked to comment on Savage Rumbaugh. Excuse me for turning the pages. On Savage Rumbaugh's work. It has to do with communication. The controversy masked an uncomfortable truth. No one agreed on what the difference between language and communication actually was. The distinction goes back to Aristotle. While animals could exchange information about what they felt, he wrote, only humans could articulate what was just and unjust. And this made their vocalizations speech. In the 1600s, the philosopher René Descartes echoed this idea. While animals jabbered nonsensically, he wrote, God had gifted human beings with souls and with souls language and consciousness. In the modern era, the influential linguist Noam Chomsky theorized that human beings possess a unique language organ in the brain. While human languages might sound and look different from one another, Chomsky wrote in the 1960s, all of them are united by universal rules that no other animal communication system shares. According to Chomsky's early work, this set of rules distinguishes the sounds and gestures we make when we talk from the dances of bees, the twittering of birds, and the spectral keening of whales. It's the magic ingredient that makes our languages uniquely capable of reflecting reality. Today, many contemporary experts trace speech not to a pattern common in all human languages, but rather to what the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein called a form of life, the combination of vocalizations and rituals that overlap to produce a shared culture. That Kanzai began to use the lexigrams to communicate without previous direct training suggested that he was building a novel form of life with the researchers studying him. Their interactions, which grew more complex with time, implied to many researchers that language was not a biological endowment, but a dynamic social instrument accessible by brains that weren't human. Kanzai's aptitudes raised a tantalizing question. Had sustained exposure to human culture since infancy physically transformed his brain, or had it tapped into a capacity free-living bonobos were already exercising among themselves, unbeknownst to us. To explore this possibility, in 1994, Savage Rumbaugh spent several months studying bonobos in the Luo Scientific Reserve in the Democratic Republic of Congo. "I almost didn't come back," she told me. "If it hadn't been for my attachment to Duane and Kanzai and Panban Isha, Kanzai's younger sister, I would have happily stayed." Back in Georgia, the bonobos were growing more sophisticated. Panban Isha was starting to exhibit capabilities that equaled Kanzai's, confirming that he wasn't simply an ape savant. Savage Rumbaugh spent most of her time in their quarters. She increasingly communicated with them via high-pitched vocalizations and gestures, in addition to the lexigram keyboards. And when the bonobo females needed to help with a newborn, she slept alongside them. The bonobos' behavior changed. They began making more declarative statements, comments, and remarks, contradicting previous research, suggesting that captive great apes were capable only of mimicry or of making requests. By the early 2000s, Savage Rumbaugh published images of geometric figures drawn in chalk by Panban Isha, each corresponding roughly to a lexigram. Even more startling, however, the bonobos were exhibiting the ability to lie. "A common strategy was to send me out of the room on an errand," Savage Rumbaugh wrote in the book Machiavellian Intelligence, a collection of academic papers about the role of social experience in the evolution of human intellect. "Then, while I was gone, she, Matata, would grab hold of something that was in someone else's hands and scream as though she were being attacked. When I rushed back in, she would look at me with a pleading expression on her face and make threatening sounds at the other party. She acted as though they had taken something from her or hurt her and solicited my support in attacking them." Had they not been able to explain that they did nothing to her in my absence, I would have tended to side with Matata and support her, as she always managed to appear to have been grievously wronged. Deception in primates had been reported before, but this was something new. Matata was doing more than lying to Savage Rumbaugh. She was attempting to manipulate her into a false belief that a colleague had done something wrong. Well, that wraps up our time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen, and we thank them for their support. If you have any questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.